The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre with your Corvallis City meetings for the week of May 20th, 2024. On Monday, May 20th, the Corvallis City Council will be holding an executive session at 5:15 p.m. to discuss the status of a real estate property transaction. The meeting will be held in person at the downtown fire station in the Council Chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. Also on Monday, May 20th, but at 6 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a meeting. The meeting will be held in person at the downtown fire station in the Council Chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. See CorvallisOregon.gov for agenda details and information on how to attend the meeting online. On Wednesday, May 22nd at 5 p.m., the Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force meeting will be held at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue, as well as virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the virtual meeting. On Thursday, May 23rd at 4 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a work session which will be held virtually and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the virtual meeting. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
You're listening to KORC. I'm Nick Martin. The following is an excerpt from the Associated Press article, What to Expect in Oregon's Primaries, by Leah Askaranam. Primary Day. Oregon's all-male primary will be held on Tuesday. With the exception of Malheur County, all polls close at 8 p.m. Some of Malheur County's polls fall in the Mountain Time Zone, meaning they close an hour earlier, but the county doesn't release results until 9 p.m. local time. What's on the ballot? The Associated Press will provide coverage for the Democratic and Republican presidential primaries, along with primaries for Secretary of State, State Treasurer, and Attorney General. Voters will also select nominees for 23 state House races and 6 state Senate seats. The ballot includes nonpartisan offices, such as county district attorneys and state judges. Former President Donald Trump is running unopposed, though there is a write-in option on both the Democratic and Republican ballots. Biden faces Marianne Williamson. Who gets to vote? In Oregon, political parties can choose who can participate in their primaries, though the two major parties traditionally opt for closed primaries. That means that only voters registered with a political party may participate in that party's primary. Democrats may not vote in the Republican primary or vice versa. Independent or unaffiliated voters may not participate in either primary. Delegate allocation rules. Oregon's 66 pledged Democratic delegates are allocated according to the national party's standard rules. 15 at-large delegates are allocated in proportion to the statewide vote, as are 7 PLEO delegates, or party leaders and elected officials. The state's 6 congressional districts have a combined 44 delegates at stake, which are allocated in proportion to the vote results in each district. Candidates must receive at least 15% of the statewide vote to qualify for any statewide delegates, and 15% of the vote in a congressional district to qualify for delegates in that district. There are 31 delegates at stake in the Republican presidential primary, all of which go to the winner of the primary. Because Trump is the only Republican on the ballot, he will receive all of the state's GOP delegates. Decision notes. In the 3rd district open seat, there are 5 candidates on the Democratic ballot, though the top 3 fundraisers, Dexter, Jayapal, and Morales, represent parts of Multnomah County, which encompasses nearly all of Portland. While most of Multnomah County falls in the 3rd Congressional District, a western sliver falls into the 1st Congressional District. Multnomah County runs along the northern border of the district, just south of Vancouver, Washington. In the 4th District, Despain, the chosen candidate of Republican leadership, appears on the ballot alongside Corser. As of the May 1st filing deadline, Despain had raised $273,000, while Corsair had raised $27,000. The AP does not make projections and will declare a winner only when it's determined there is no scenario that would allow the trailing candidates to close the gap. If a race has not been called, the AP will continue to cover any newsworthy developments, such as candidate concessions or declarations of victory. In doing so, the AP will make clear that it has not yet declared a winner and explain why. Oregon has automatic recounts if the margin between the top two candidates is 0.2% or less. Candidates can request recounts regardless of the margin, but they must pay for them. The AP may declare a winner in a race that is eligible for a recount if it can determine the lead is too large for a recount or legal challenge to change the outcome. What do turnout and advance vote look like? As of April 1st, there were 3,032,333 registered voters in Oregon. Of those, 33% were Democrats and 24% were Republicans. In the 2022 Senate race, turnout was 17% of registered voters in the Democratic primary and 12% in the Republican primary. How long does vote counting usually take? In the 2022 primary election, the AP first reported results at 8:04 p.m. or 4 minutes after polls closed. The election night tabulation ended at 2:48 a.m. with about 77% of total votes counted. Again, this was an excerpt from the article "What to Expect in Oregon's Primaries," written by Leah Askaranam with the Associated Press. As for local elections here in our town, there are three positions with seats up for grabs, at least that will be on the Tuesday primary. Two Benton County Commissioner spots are being contended for. Position 2 is up for grabs after Commissioner Zan Ogiero decided not to file to run again. Corvallis City Councilor Gabe Shepard and local loan officer Liz Irish are running for the Democratic seat. With no Republican contenders, whoever wins this Tuesday will effectively be the new commissioner for Position 2. Incumbent Benton County Commissioner Nancy Wise will be defending her Position 3 spot against Republican contender Keith Lemke. They are both running unopposed in their respective parties and may end up competing against each other this November. The final race is for State Representative for Oregon House District 16, for which Sarah Finger McDonald and Sammy L. Abdraba are contending. Ballots are due by 8 p.m. Tuesday evening, and ballot drop-off sites can be found in front of the courthouse in downtown, the Kalapuya Building on Research Way, Gill Coliseum on the OSU campus, the Corvallis Public Library, the Law Enforcement Building on 5th Street, the Corvallis Community Center on Tyler Avenue, and the LBCC Benton Center, among other places. Go to bentoncountyor.gov for a list of more ballot drop-off sites. You're listening to KORC.
Well, good afternoon. This is Dan Krall. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. You can hear this program on Sundays from 1 to 2 p.m. and Mondays 5 to 6. We also archive this news program at our website, korcfm.com. Here's another segment of Civics in Action. I pay attention to little details around town, things like road signs, stickers that are placed, and here along 4th Street, I can't help but notice the troglodyte vandal has returned. Who's that, you might ask? Somebody's been putting "Let's Go Brandon" stickers along various public road signs, a blue sticker. Some of you may have seen this along 5th Street. For a time, they were all along like bus signs. I must take credit. I, Dan Krall, took them down. And I see that the vandal has returned with his very unclever, very not funny sticker. So I'm here to scrape it off. And why? I know it's not my job. But if I call Public Works, I'll get the runaround, say it's ODOT's job because it's along 4th Street. Then I'll call ODOT and I'll leave a message and no one will ever return my call because nobody checks voicemail anymore. So And I could be wrong about all that, but I don't think so. Been down that road a few times. I know a quicker way, though, just to do it myself. And this is a small action. I'm not changing the world right now by removing a Let's Go Brandon sticker, but I'm not going to look at this. Look at this. Didn't even put it on right. It's all wadded. As poor as the aesthetic of the phrase itself, Let's Go Brandon. And you know we're going to be stuck with this phrase for years to come due to lack of originality, due to lack of much sense of humor. And honestly, another reason I'm doing this, I don't think anybody else is going to do this. I don't honestly think anybody else is going to take the time to come and scrape this down. I brought a stepladder. I'm doing this on my own time. As I record this, it's a Tuesday afternoon. It's actually just started raining on me as I'm recording this, but still going to do it. I've removed a number of Let's Go Brandon stickers from various signs, and I'm going to keep doing it. So if you are the person out there who's putting these stickers up, I am happy to counter your efforts. I am thrilled to be the counterbalance to your poor sticker job. And every time I see your stickers, every time, I'm going to take them down. So if you notice these Let's Go Brandon stickers coming and going, I got to take credit where it's due. I'm not trying to brag. But I'd also like to encourage you out there listening. Corvallis is not the city it used to be. It used to be a lot more quaint, a lot more clean. I feel like we've lost our way in a number of ways, but little actions, whether it's picking up garbage off the roadside, helping someone in need, removing Let's Go Brandon stickers, we all play a part. And I mean, I'm not going to be mad about these stickers. I'm not going to drive past them and say, someone should take that down. I should take it down, and I am. I'm actually walking up to this next sign here, speed limit 25, right near the corner of Polk and 4th, where a second Let's Go Brandon sticker has been placed. This does not belong. Let's get on my stepladder here. Scrape it off. Due to the poor quality of the sticker, it is not scraping off very easily. These are very poor quality print. Not just the message, but the quality itself. I'm slowly scraping it off. It doesn't belong. So back to what I was saying, I really would encourage you. You know, various things in this world that need counterbalance, that need someone else to step in. I feel like especially since the pandemic, we've seen we don't have it made, we don't have all the answers, and all the resources won't be there. But in little small ways, we can make a difference. Got the sticker about half removed here. Let's go, Brandon. I'm not going to be mad that nobody else is doing it. I'm happy to do this. And I feel like that's kind of where the civics in action really comes in. I know this is not my job, and I don't want to be paid to do this. Yeah, if you're the perpetrator, keep putting them up. I'm going to keep scraping them down every time. And if something happens to me or I become unable to get myself up to scrape these Let's Go Brandon stickers down, I can't do this all by myself, right? If you see a Let's Go Brandon sticker in town, on public property that is, I wouldn't touch anything on private property. But here's another Let's Go Brandon sticker on the back of this stop sign. And even though my stepladder is sinking into the dirt as I'm trying to get a position here. There we go. Oh, nope. Wow. This mud here is very, it's like quicksand. There we go. Oh, that one just peeled right off. Let's go, Brandon, indeed. Right to the trash bin. And I think that's it for now, because I just removed the three I had been looking at. They had just been up for a few days. And this is Dan Kroll with Civics in Action. Just successfully removed three stickers that just didn't belong in the public space. And I want to encourage you, find that boldness. What are you afraid of? You know, this life is our one chance to be authentic and just live the life we believe. I certainly don't spend a lot of my time doing just this, but I try to volunteer where I see needs. And I'm not always consistent, right? I don't do it every week. But when I can and when I make intention and time, it feels good to clean up trash, to alleviate problems where I know I can. I cannot solve all the world's problems by any means, but where I can, I'm going to make a difference, and I would encourage you to do the same. Thanks for tuning in today to KORC News, Music, and Civics. You can hear this program Sundays from 1 to 2, Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. on KORC.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. Hi, everyone. This is JC, and I'm sitting here today near the Saturday Market talking with Hezekiah, a local musician here. He's testing out his drums to see how the sound is. Because it's cooler out today, he's checking how tight the drums are. So Hezekiah, you mentioned something earlier about coming here to the Saturday Market and being in a different spot, and now you feel like a lot of musicians here are kind of isolated and put back away from the crowd. How long have you been coming to the market like this, playing your drums?
I've been in Corvallis for 15 years, and not until probably about 7 or 8 years into me being here did I start to I had the right setup, so I played in the market, something that's serene and beautiful for a couple years, and then COVID hit, and then I started playing right here.
Okay, so when you say right here, for those of you that can't see us, we're off Monroe, and we're back behind the main walking area of the market. Amongst the trees. Last time I saw you, we were at the dedication to the new skate bowl. And you said something that I thought was really important about culture. Do you remember that at all?
Just the culture of skateboarding, which is, then we're talking about skateboarding, then that's usually basically super counterculture, and the people that come down there are of different thoughts, and also people would drink and smoke down there as basically rebels and outlaws and so on and so forth like that, and even little kids. But as of I'm originally from Michigan, and coming to Oregon, how much there is not that much culture here, because a lot of it's basically cowboys and red-bearded lumberjacks and all that stuff. So the stuff that I'm doing is invoking a different kind of culture, because I'm thinking the culture that's perpetuating is predominantly rock and roll, punk, and folk, and that has not manifested anything, you know, like no gods coming down to earth or anything like that. So if we keep on perpetuating that, we're gonna have the same results. Same thing with the politicians, same thing with the religions. Keep on chanting those mantras to like a god that's went offline, expecting something to happen out of it.
So you mentioned also how the skate bowl and just the culture of the skateboarding brings a positivity to that area that it needs, too. I remember you saying something about that.
Well, yeah, because that area is basically, looks like a bomb went off, and there's garbage, and there's people yelling, there's people ODing. And when I used to be here, everybody was just down by the river, like jumping in their neck and all that stuff. We didn't have to worry about like camps and all that stuff. You can go for a walk without, you know, hearing, you know, the death knell of the failed society. So it has changed a lot. And then their solution now right now is basically is sweep people all over the place and be like, live in the parks. And parks are meant for like people playing frisbee and kids playing and all that stuff. And why then also like they want people being in the parks, but they don't provide a actual legitimate spot or any porta potty. So it's basically like sleep in the park where kids play and take dumps in the grass.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, I know they've got that hotel.
Yeah, I'm at the motel right now, but that's going to be demolished June 30th. It's going to turn into, that was going to be a transitional house, and then it's going to turn into a 30 to 50 unit permanent supportive housing. Yeah, the mixture of permanent supportive housing and tiny houses are 100% success, and they're spending about $30,000 every time they sweep people. That could have been used basically to get people rehabilitated on their foot. I've seen people once they got a shower and a toilet, within 2 weeks they look like a new person.
Absolutely. So you also work at the drop-in center. Tell us a little bit about that and your work there.
Basically, I was going to the drop-in center since I've been here, and it's been many different locations, and then I joined the board, and then during COVID I became a volunteer, then I became staff. Basically, a drop-in center is basically a hub to get people connected to services, and we don't force people to do anything. They connect to the service, they can get the bare essentials like, you know, a sack lunch, clothing, whatever we get donated and all that stuff. And then it's also a place where people can just, you know, connect with other people in the neighborhood.
That's really cool. And you're one of the staff now, you said.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. When I first got there, all I had was like peanut butter and jelly and like minor services, but they hired a new executive director. So we've been basically, COVID happened and the city basically was just like not there, and we basically improvised and pulled stuff together. And this most recent ice storm, the city was basically like, here you go, we're not going to do anything, and it's throwing all the burdens on our community, and like, and the community is overburdened. If COVID didn't happen, I see the old people who are volunteering, they're like in their 70s, 80s, they wouldn't be able to deal with the new batch of people that are like, after COVID, like, and then fentanyl and all that stuff, it's like heightened everyone's mental health, and it's like, it's off the chain out there.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you help people get resources that they normally couldn't get.
No, they could get them, but the rigmarole and the paperwork and
gotcha.
The discrimination and the phone calls and the system, like, basically makes it hard for anyone to get on their foot. If someone wants to get drug treatment, they gotta wait 6 months. If someone wants to get off alcohol, they gotta wait 6 months. So when someone's trying to do right, they make it really hard for them to get right.
Now, what do you think about that new crisis center that's going up?
It's only gonna be like 6 beds. The drop-in center was in the bill with the new justice center, and they're basically gonna get a new justice center. We're gonna get our navigation center to expand. Right now, we're going to fit like 15 people in our building. We got this really small building, and we are just overburdened. It was going to be the jail and us, and we were in the same bill, but most people voted against that bill because, like, mm-hmm. the jail was getting, like, $97 million, and we're getting, like, $3 million. People was like, nah, we're doing the stuff that the jail's not doing, like trying to get people out of jail, transitioning to something, get them to housing, trying to get people a warm handoff. They, like, kick someone out of jail or a mental facility, and then put them right on the streets, and it's like, then they end up back into the
exactly.
same cycle.
Exactly. It's that cyclical thing. It just goes around and around and around. So it sounds like you know the system pretty well.
I don't know all the jargon and the acronyms, but I work with a lot of people. I was trying to do, like, independent street work with people that were basically, like, I crashed with a woman that, like, people were stealing from her and, like, leaving bloody needles on the front porch. And after that, like, I start teaming with people because it was like, you can't do it, like, by yourself. So
right.
team with people that know this and know all this stuff. And they bring me to me because I actually know what's going on, and I'm intelligent enough. But some of the stuff they be saying is like, you know, why are you making the language all obscure for people to not even know what the hell they're talking about? Paperwork is like that, too. Like, this paperwork is like, even me, like, paperwork is like, what the heck's going on here?
Yeah, it is complicated, and it's long-winded. When did you start getting into drumming?
I came here originally playing a bugle, and then a guy that will be coming and playing with me later, this guy Dave Storrs, he recognized soon as I played the drums that like I was built for it, and portion of my past is playing basketball, so it reminds me of playing basketball. And then he taught me just the rudiments of it, and then I started researching further about, you know, Santeria, Capoeira, and I don't count or anything like that, but I've been okay. The drums are, I don't have to think as much. With the horn, I gotta think about A, B, C, B, and G and all that stuff, but with the drums, it's just like, that's where the voodoo and the trance comes from. Gotcha. Like, then you're gonna start to invoking the gods, which for me, it takes, you know, over 5 hours. Like, that's why at about 2 hour mark, I'm just like, then my body is able to do the stuff that I wanted to do, and people don't really have that much time, you know. Luckily, at the Old Rodeli, they give you 3 hours for a performance, so when I play there, if I start off, you know, without that much momentum, by the time the second set, then I'm cooking.
As a frequent attendee of the Saturday Market, I really love hearing your drums. It sounds like a song that somebody who's not aware of how drumming works and the syncopation and all of that. Sometimes you'll have a guitarist here, and sometimes it'll just be you or someone else is playing next to you, playing the drums. So it's really nice to be able to hear that. It's not, because at the Saturday Market, people will play their instruments, right? And they just play sometimes the same ones over and over, or they bring their amplifiers. You don't need any of that.
Yeah, I think that's a no-no down here. This guy set up the other day, go right by me, knew I was over here and started doing the amplifier, and then we had to tell him to leave. But yeah, there's not a lot of variety here. Like, there's usually mainly like little kids on violins and then the folk band, or it's usually typical Corvallis. They're not really intimidated or discriminating stuff that has no genre or is rooted in something else. I mean, they act like they want diversity, act like they want that, but they keep on booking the same stuff, and people want better. People want a lot better in a lot of things. With that skate park thing, I was supposed to DJ. All the kids love hip-hop. I go down there and play hip-hop, and then the person that booked it booked all nothing but punk. So they're like sort of just out of touch with actuality and all that stuff. I mean, when you guys do fundraisers, who do you guys book? Make mixes and stuff like that too, so I'm going to eventually give a USB to one of my friends, Lauren, that does DJ stuff.
So tell me more about the mix that you say that you... Are you DJ?
Not really, because I don't have records. I basically just bootleg everything off of YouTube, and I got a whole bunch of channels, and I mainly, like, narrow down the search. So I just, like, there's gamelan music, Australian music, a lot of, Japanese geisha music. I like early honky-tonk, any European gypsy music,
okay.
Sorts of African music, but, like, field recordings, like obscure African, not like some Ladysmith, Black Mambazo, this like commercial sort of stuff. Afrobeat, all sorts of capoeira stuff, and early blues, earlier jazz. And the person that made me delve into different kind of music, because I grew up on basically, you know, R&B, funk, soul, and
yep.
hip-hop.
Yep.
I listened to Sade first, and that yep. was like, whoa. And then we had a radio station, a college radio station, WCBN in Ann Arbor, and I heard Sun Ra for the first time. And I was just like, after that, I was just like, I didn't believe that kind of music exists. Because when people, I played Sun Ra for people, they'd be like, that's not jazz. And it was like, because he had these drowsy horn melodies and drums and all this stuff. And
yeah.
Everyone knows Miles Davis and John Coltrane, which makes me cringe. I don't dislike those, but it was like when I mentioned Sun Ra, I was like, who's Sun Ra? I was like, Facebook now. I got a number, and you can message me.
Very cool. So what's your profile name on Facebook?
It's just my regular name, Hezekiah Franklin.
Franklin. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So listeners, if you're interested in learning more about Hezekiah, his music, his philosophy, he has some wonderful ideas that I would love to go down a rabbit hole with him on. But anyway, check out his Facebook page, Hezekiah Franklin. So we're going to listen to a little bit of Hezekiah's music. Hezekiah, thank you so much. That was Hezekiah Franklin, who's an artist when it comes to drumming and syncopation. You can find him every Saturday at the Saturday Market, sometimes with a guitarist and sometimes just on his own. He has multiple drums, and once he gets going and warmed up, his music is incredible. He's also a staff member at the Drop-In Center and a strong advocate for people with mental health disorders and people without homes. He's going to be performing on Wednesday, May 22nd, at the Old World Deli with his friend DJ Nails doing a DJ mix. Also, on Friday, May 31st, the Drop-In Center will be hosting an art gallery featuring much of the artistry and visual arts from people who need the services of the Drop-In Center. You might be surprised at some of the incredible art that you will see. It will be across the street from the Drop-In Center starting at noon on Friday, May 31st, at 523 Northwest 4th Street. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics.
I know, you're scared. You're worried that for some reason, someday, you'll have to journey beyond the few precious square miles that KORC can be heard from. No one knows what's outside our protective news, music, and civics low-power FM force field. Dragons? Robots? Commercial radio? What's a long-time listener, first-time caller to do? Well, if you have an Apple device, you can now listen to KORC from anywhere in the world. Download it from the Apple App Store for iPhone, iPad, and Macs today.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Power and corruption abuse that comes with any power are manifested in different ways and areas in the Israeli society as in any other society. But the Israeli domination over the Palestinians has been the most vile, cruel, destructive, and dangerous of all, and the least covered by the Israeli press in general.
Longtime Israeli journalist Amira Haas. As Israel intensifies its attacks on Gaza and South Africa calls on the International Court of Justice to order Israel to halt its assault on Rafah, we spend the hour with Haaretz correspondent Amira Haas, the only Israeli Jewish journalist to have spent 30 years living in and reporting from Gaza and the West Bank. This week, she addressed the graduating class of the Columbia Journalism School. Many of the student journalists there threatened with arrest as they dared to go outside their doors to cover what was happening on the Columbia campus, with well over 100 students arrested as a Gaza solidarity encampment.
The journalism that I chose to practice is based on the refusal to see injustice as normal, the refusal to normalize it to a point that we do not see it. This is exactly what the students here in Colombia and in so many other campuses in the US and now in Europe have been doing. Refuse to accept hell as normal.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's deadly attacks throughout the Gaza Strip are intensifying, with thousands more Palestinians in northern Gaza now cut off from food and water, as Israel says its troops are fighting in Jabalia's city center. Israel's attacks on Rafah are also ongoing, after more than 500,000 people taking refuge in the southern city were forced to flee. The U.S. said its first aid shipments have started via its temporary Gaza pier after several weeks of construction. But the UN reiterated that all humanitarian access points to Gaza need to be opened up.
To stave off the horrors of famine, we must use the fastest and most obvious route to reach the people of Gaza. And for that, we need access by land.
That was the UN Secretary General's deputy spokesperson, Farhan Haq. Many Gazans have rejected the U.S. pier. These are displaced Palestinians in Nuseirat.
We don't want ships. We want the border crossing to open. For people to come and go, we want safety. We want official borders. Those planes as well that they bring here with the parachutes, and they throw food at us like dogs, like beggars. That does not work. It falls on houses. It falls on people. It brings us problems.
We reject dealing with the ships and the American ships because in the same way it gives us, it will take away from us. Maybe they want to take over the gas fields that are in the sea, or maybe they are here to displace the Palestinian people and to transfer people from one country to another.
Spain has denied port access to an Israeli-bound ship from India carrying explosives. Spain says it will no longer allow ships with weapons for Israel to use its ports. Spain has also vowed to recognize Palestinian statehood by July. Foreign ministers from 13 countries signed onto a letter warning Israel to halt its ground operations in Rafah and to get more aid to Palestinians. The letter was signed by all G7 members, minus the United States, Germany, France, the UK, Italy, Japan, and Canada, as well as the foreign ministers of Australia, Denmark, the Netherlands, New Zealand, South Korea, and Sweden. In The Hague, the International Court of Justice has ordered representatives for Israel to submit more information about humanitarian conditions in its so-called evacuation zones in Gaza by tomorrow. The request came as the ICJ closed its second day of hearings on South Africa's request for emergency measures to halt Israel's assault on Rafah. Israel denied its carrying out a genocide in Gaza as it addressed the court today. Briefings were halted for a moment when a protester yelled liars as the Israeli delegation spoke. Yesterday, South Africa presented its case.
Israel's genocide has continued apace and has just reached a new and horrific stage. Israel has sought to hide its crimes through the weaponization of international humanitarian law. It pretends that the civilians it ruthlessly kills through its 2,000-pound bombs, through its targeted airstrikes, through its artificial intelligence systems, through its executions, are human shields.
We'll have more on the World Court hearings later in the broadcast. Police continued their violent crackdown on student Gaza solidarity protests this week with arrests and raids Thursday at University of California, Berkeley, as well as DePaul University in Chicago. This is DePaul student body president Parveen Mundi.
It's really important to us that, you know, for the people of Palestine, knowing that, you know, I'm a student body president and I go to a university, and at the same time, there are no universities left in Gaza. We're all responsible for making sure that our tuition dollars aren't going towards genocide.
Faculty at Morehouse College, a historically black college in Atlanta, Georgia, voted 50-38 in favor of conferring an honorary doctorate to President Biden when he delivers a commencement speech on Sunday. Biden's visit to Morehouse has been met with protests from students over his response to what's happening in Gaza. In New York State, students at Bard College have just taken over the school's administration building. Meanwhile, Columbia students and faculty on Thursday celebrated an alternative people's graduation at the nearby Cathedral of St. John the Divine. We'll have more from that ceremony later in the broadcast. This comes as the Washington Post reports a group of billionaires and business interests privately pressured New York City Mayor Eric Adams to deploy police on pro-Palestinian protests at Columbia University. A WhatsApp group with some of the country's wealthiest people detailed donations to Adams' campaign and conversations with the mayor. Some of those involved include real estate magnate Barry Sternlicht, Daniel Lubetsky, founder of the Kind Snacks brand, hedge fund manager Daniel Loeb, and founder of Thor Equities, Joseph Sitt. The U.S. Supreme Court rejected a challenge to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's funding mechanism that could have undermined the agency charged with protecting borrowers from predatory loans and other abuses by banks and financial entities. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich praised the justices for protecting the CFPB from, quote, attacks by shady payday lenders, adding since 2011, the CFPB has put $17.5 billion back in the pockets of 200 million Americans who have been defrauded, unquote. In other Supreme Court news, the New York Times is reporting an upside-down U.S. flag, which is a symbol used by Trump supporters and election deniers, hung outside the home of Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito in January 2021, just days before Biden's inauguration. The revelations are expected to reignite calls for Justice Alito to recuse himself from cases related to the January 6th insurrection, including Trump's attempt to claim immunity from election subversion charges. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has pardoned Daniel Perry, the U.S. Army sergeant who was convicted and sentenced to 25 years for murdering Black Lives Matter protester Garrett Foster in 2020. Ahead of the murder, Perry posted on social media he planned to shoot, quote, looters, and posted dozens of racist and Islamophobic messages and images. While people with felonies are not permitted to own firearms in Texas, Governor Abbott's pardon means Perry will be legally allowed to carry and possess a gun. In other news from Texas, at least four people are dead, nearly a million are without power, after heavy rains and powerful storms battered the Houston area Thursday night, causing massive floods and destruction. The Biden administration's moving to end all new coal leasing in the Powder River Basin of Wyoming and Montana, the largest coal-producing region in the United States. The move comes in response to a lawsuit by environmental groups. Meanwhile, in Florida, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has signed a bill that removes all references to climate change in state law and weakens regulations on pipelines, among other measures. The move eliminates climate change as a priority in Florida's energy policy decisions, despite Florida being on the front lines of the climate crisis as it faces worsening hurricanes, rising sea levels, extreme heat, and toxic algae blooms. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, families gathered Wednesday to bury nearly two dozen children who were killed earlier this month after rocket attacks on camps for displaced people near the city of Goma. Another 13 victims, mostly women, were also buried. Mourners blame the M23 armed group for the killings and condemn neighboring Rwanda for backing the group. This is Congolese Human Rights Minister Albert Fabrice Puela.
A Congolese genocide for economic reasons is being perpetrated in our country by Rwanda. War crimes, such as those of May 3rd and Mugunga, crimes against humanity, have all been documented.
Rwanda has denied the accusation, saying the attacks were likely carried out by militias backed by the Congolese army. Intensifying violence in the eastern DRC has forced hundreds of thousands to flee as armed groups vie for control of the country's natural resources.
There are a lot of foreign countries behind Rwanda President Paul Kagame, and they're killing my people because of the minerals that the Congo has. If they want to work with the Congo, they shouldn't go through Kagame. Let them come and negotiate with us, and we'll know how to make the ore available to them so that we can all benefit from it.
In other news about Rwanda, Human Rights Watch said Rwandan immigration authorities denied entry to one of its researchers this week. Human Rights Watch said the move, quote, exposes the government's deep-seated hostility to human rights monitoring and independent scrutiny of any kind, unquote. Back in the U.S., immigrant rights groups continue to demand the Biden administration immediately halt deportations to Haiti and enact protections for Haitian migrants as the island nation faces a worsening humanitarian crisis, deepening gang violence and political instability. Advocates said Thursday another group of Haitian asylum seekers have been deported, the second deportation flight since April. The Haitian Bridge Alliance said the, quote, deeply troubling policy places vulnerable individuals individuals in grave danger, unquote. And the Biden administration took a major step towards reclassifying marijuana from Schedule I drug to Schedule III. The move will not decriminalize marijuana, but acknowledges its medical benefits and differentiates it from lethal drugs like heroin or meth. The move would also ease tax burdens on states that have legalized marijuana sales. Biden hailed the monumental step Thursday.
No one should be in jail merely for using or possessing marijuana, period. Far too many lives have been upended because of failed approach to marijuana, and I'm committed to righting those wrongs.
As a senator, Joe Biden authored the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, enacting new mandatory minimum sentences for drugs, including marijuana. The law led to a fivefold increase in the jailing of black people. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report.
Where you go, I will go, my friend. Where you go, I will go. Where you go, I will go, my friend. Where you go, I will go. 'Cause your people are my people. Your people are my. Your people are my people. Our struggles align.
Where you go, I will go, sung by the Liberated Zone, a folk troupe that began when the members were part of the Gaza Solidarity encampment at Columbia University. They sang the song while they were being arrested by the NYPD. They performed Thursday at the People's Graduation, a gathering for justice and peace at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
That was a segment from Democracy Now!, which aired on Friday, May 17th, 2024. For more national and international news, go to democracynow.org. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre with your Corvallis City Meetings for the week of May 20th, 2024. On Monday, May 20th, the Corvallis City Council will be holding an executive session at 5:15 p.m. to discuss the status of a real estate property transaction. The meeting will be held in person at the downtown fire station in the Council Chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. Also on Monday, May 20th, but at 6 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a meeting. The meeting will be held in person at the downtown fire station in the Council Chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. See CorvallisOregon.gov for agenda details and information on how to attend the meeting online. On Wednesday, May 22nd at 5 p.m., the Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force meeting will be held at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue, as well as virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the virtual meeting. On Thursday, May 23rd at 4 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a work session which will be held virtually and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the virtual meeting. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
The Malheur National Wildlife Refuge is located south of the town of Burns in the Harney Basin. The main route to the headquarters is on Highway 205 for 26 miles, and then you head 6 miles east on Sod House Lane to this secluded location. It has several buildings located on the property, and this time of year is especially vibrant with wildlife, particularly birds, who are stopping off during their various migrations. The refuge has a few short trails and is situated overlooking a vast wetland and field where the public is not permitted. There are around 24 buildings, many now in various degrees of disrepair. The site was constructed in 1965 as a Job Corps youth camp before it lost its funding and closed 4 years later in 1969. It now serves as a national wildlife refuge, where wildlife comes first, and where people can experience the beauty of the natural world in a truly wild place. Back on January 2nd of 2016, an armed group of far-right extremists seized and occupied the headquarters of the National Wildlife Refuge here at Malheur. And it continued to occupy it until law enforcement made a final arrest on February 11th of 2016. The leader of this ragtag effort was Amon Bundy, who participated in the 2014 Bundy standoff at his father's Nevada ranch. Other members of the group were loosely affiliated with various non-governmental militias and the Sovereign Citizen Movement. You've seen the videos of traffic stops with sovereign citizens, where a harebrained existential debate arises and usually results in their forceful arrest, instead of just handing over their license and registration. According to Wikipedia, the organizers were seeking an opportunity to advance their view that the federal government is constitutionally required to turn over most of the federal public land that they manage to the individual states, in particular, land managed by the Bureau of Land Management, also known as BLM, as well as the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, the United States Forest Service, and other agencies. In 2015, the militants believed that they could do this by protesting the treatment of two area ranchers in Burns, the Hammonds, who were convicted of federal land arson. They believe they were wrongly convicted, even though the two men in question, Dwight and Stephen Dwight Hammond, they were father and son, did not want the assistance of this group. The occupation began when Bundy led an armed party to the refuge headquarters following a peaceful public rally in the city of Burns. By February 11th, all of the militants had surrendered or withdrawn from the occupation, with several leaders having been arrested after leaving the site. One of them, Robert Lavoy Finicum, was shot and killed during an attempt to arrest him after he reached toward a handgun concealed in his pocket, after he tried to evade a roadblock. Ryan Bundy was wounded. More than 24 of the militants were charged with federal offenses, including conspiracy to obstruct federal officers, firearms violations, theft, and depredation of federal property. By August of 2017, 12 had pleaded guilty, and 6 of those had been sentenced to 1 to 2 years probation, some including house arrest. 7 others, including the leaders of this takeover, Amon and Ryan Bundy, were tried and acquitted of all federal charges. 5 more had been found guilty and were sentenced months later. 7 of the militants saw prison time for their roles in the occupation. Jake Ryan and Dwayne Amer each received 366 days in prison, with Ryan additionally getting 3 years of supervised probation. John Ritzheimer was sentenced to 366 days in federal prison and another 12 months in a residential reentry program. 2 others, Joe O'Shaughnessy and Brian Cavalier were detained for at least a year but released on time served plus 3 years of supervision each, and they also incurred some fines. The federal jury found brothers Amon and Ryan Bundy and five others not guilty of conspiring to impede federal workers from doing their jobs during the 41-day armed takeover that ended on February 11th of 2016 at the refuge. Those of us who followed the case were appalled at the injustice, knowing full well that from the get-go, had this been people of color, perhaps a Muslim extremist group, a left-wing anarchist setup, the feds would have most certainly moved in with lethal force. The perps would have no chance to even see a trial in a courtroom. The precedent that was set by this national disgrace and legal failure has paved the way for what we saw on the day of the failed coup, January 6th, 2021, and perhaps worse to come. The Malheur National Wildlife Refuge is a beautiful place, one that should be protected not just for the natural world, but should have had a much better protection from a domestic terrorist ring who intimidated workers, desecrated the space, and clearly violated the law. Amon Bundy's shenanigans didn't end with his acquittal from multiple legal offenses. During the COVID-19 pandemic, he was arrested more than five times for protests and disruption against COVID-19 mitigation efforts by the Idaho government. He ran for governor of Idaho in the 2022 election. He initially wanted to run as a Republican, but he decided instead to run as an independent in the general election, and he lost. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Dan Krall at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, south of Burns, Oregon.
Hi neighbors, this is Claire Gilgannon here to talk with you about turkey vultures. Yes folks, you heard me correctly, I said turkey vultures. Those wonderful darlings of decay we often see soaring on thermals above our neighborhoods or in the wide open spaces of agricultural grasslands and riparian zones. Did you know that turkey vultures consume, nearly exclusively, the dead and decaying flesh of animals killed by disease, roadside collision, or natural causes? Yes, absolutely metal as fuck, I know. They lack the strength in their talons to grasp and kill live prey, so instead use their keen sense of sight and smell to locate their dead meals. By consuming decaying flesh, turkey vultures provide a key ecosystem service to all of us. Not only do they remove what would otherwise be left to rot, turkey vultures are also immune to many communicable diseases, including the rabies virus, which can infect pets, livestock, and humans, and is always fatal if left untreated. Turkey vultures don't give a fuck. They digest it and then even regurgitate it for their babies. And a turkey vulture that consumes infected meat effectively removes it from the environment, thereby reducing the presence of diseases that could otherwise harm us. So give them a break. Take a moment to appreciate the next turkey vulture you spot. And if you see a turkey vulture feasting on a carcass alongside a road or highway, give them space. Change lanes if it's safe to do so, or slow down to reduce the chance the birds will attempt to take flight. Collision with vehicles injures and kills thousands of turkey vultures each year, and we need them around. Understand and respect their place in the ecosystem. You are listening to KORC.